when she was 12 or 13, they were reunified after all these steps of writing letters and phone calls and Zooms. And finally, now they have a relationship. And it's like one of the greatest things I could have ever been involved in, because it was heartbreaking. And he said to me something like, because he never gave up. And he never just said, you know what, forget it, this is too hard. He just said, I need to be able to show her whenever it is, whether it's when she's an adult or when she's 12, that I did everything I could. And here's every time I went to court and I asked and I asked and I asked and I tried, because I don't want her to think that I just gave up and said, you know what, I don't care about this relationship.
Hi, my name is Mina Kim, your host of The Click Line. I've worked on Wall Street for over 14 years. Then I built out Orange Theory Fitnesses and sold them to a private equity firm. And upon that exit, started investing in women and minority startups, as well as advising women who are getting divorced with financial consulting and strategy. Hey guys, you know what's the best way to get in touch with your friends? Sharing an episode of the Click Line podcast. So don't forget to like, subscribe, and share the episodes. And let me know what you think in the comments. Welcome to this episode of the Click Line podcast. Today, we have a special guest, Jennifer Reamer. She is a top-rated attorney and partner of the LA-based Wasser, Cooperman, and Mandels. She is a certified family law specialist, has extensive experience representing high net worth individuals in all types of family law issues, including child custody, spousal support, property valuation, post-divorce issues, and custody modifications. Jenny has lectured extensively and authored articles on a variety of complex family law topics for the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, State Bar of California, American Bar Association, Beverly Hills Bar Association, as well as others. She was selected as Southern California's Rising Star, as well as being on the list of super lawyers, which is the top 5% in the state and is a selection process by peers, as well as a dozen of other factors, and recently has been accepted to the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, which is even more selective, where you have judges, lawyers, and on a national level, the whole application process takes over a year. So she just got accepted to that. So safe to say, Jennifer is one badass matrimonial attorney here in LA. Thank you so much for being on, Jennifer.
Well, thank you. And thank you for that introduction. That was very kind.
I'm available whenever you need me in court or anything. yeah. So if you could, for the audience, tell us about the areas of practice that you're in.
Sure. So my firm here, we do anything related to family law. So that does not include any kind of trusts and estates. It doesn't include adoption. It doesn't include surrogacy. But anything else kind of under the umbrella of family law, I do. Prenups, postnups, anything related to divorce or paternity cases, which means they weren't married, but they have children and there might be child support or custody issues.
Got it. And so where would you say you're spending most of your time?
Currently, I'm in a bit of a resting spot, thankfully, at the moment, which enabled me to be able to do this. But I've been spending a lot of time in the courtroom, had a lot of litigation recently in the last year or so. And it feels like a lot of my partners have as well. It just seems like the tenor of family law has been a bit intense recently. So I've been doing a lot of litigation, but not on any specific issue, really on a lot. People challenging prenups, contentious custody cases, just dividing up property, really anything under that umbrella of what I do.
So do you think in these cases, it could have been settled outside of court and it didn't have to go this far? Is there a huge emotional factor that's being played to make it go all the way to court?
Yes. So I think there's a few things that kind of have to exist for a case either to settle or to get all the way to court. And myself and the philosophy of the firm generally is like settlement is almost always better. You even though, you know, people say like fair is the F word in divorce, or, you know, nobody really wins in a divorce case, and all of that's kind of true. But at least you still have some modicum of control at a mediation and a settlement, whether it's all you're in, you know, at a mediation with a mediator, or if you're exchanging settlement offers via lawyers, you still ultimately are the one that gets to say like, yes, I agree to this, or no, I don't. And you have a lot more leeway outside of court than inside the court, even in what you can agree to. There's many things we can agree upon that the court can't order if we went to trial. So we really try to remind people of that and of the cost, because the amount of money that they will spend at a trial, I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars if it is a really long, contested, you know, multi-week trial.
Or years, right?
Well, sure. And you have to keep that factored into, well, do I really want to pay all of that and then still be rolling the dice? Or do I want to maybe save that? And some people will tell you, I'd rather pay you than her or him, and I don't care, and that's what I want to do. So I think when somebody's mind is really made up and they're really angry, it is much harder to keep them in that settlement context. And or I have had cases where the other side, whether it's the spouse and the lawyer, who are so incapable of being reasonable that it's kind of, you don't have a choice. And those are the most frustrating ones, because I have cases that absolutely, if the other side was more reasonable, they would have settled. These people would have saved millions of dollars, but takes two. So
is there a common theme that you're seeing in a lot of the cases that have been brought to you?
I don't know if there's one. there's maybe a few. And it depends on what you mean by theme, but I mean, there's certainly a huge amount of distrust, I mean, between people that I'm seeing. And that's, you know, very common in divorce or family law scenarios, but it seems to have been heightened, and I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's like, maybe we blame social media. I don't know what it is, but people seem to be just incredibly distrustful of each other. And that also makes it harder to settle. I think parenting from, you know, my own personal experience and from seeing how people are going through that is hard this day and age, for a lot of reasons. So I do feel like the custody type issues that are coming up really center around people's different views on parenting. I mean, we saw that during COVID, where one person wanted to vaccinate and the other person didn't. And now that issue also remains on the table with other medical kind of decision making. Because even in intact, healthy families, there's disagreement on what the best thing is for a child, right? And so now you have this added layer. And I just feel like there's a lot of litigation now about, like, well, do we do Invisalign or do we do braces? And it's like, this is what people are spending their money on.
Wow, that's insane. And so do you think any of these, just not wearing your non-attorney hat, I guess, but do you think any of these issues could have been addressed earlier before people got married?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, the parenting thing is an interesting thing, because if people know they want to have children, yeah, I mean, ideally, they would talk about kind of core values and, you know, obviously something like whether your kid's going to have braces or not. Maybe you're not going to anticipate or know your position on that, but just, you know, educational values, health, you know, now that kind of the there's a lot of kind of divisiveness around healthcare and, you know, what people's beliefs are about that. So, yeah, I do think a lot of people are not having those kind of conversations. And no judgment. Like, that's not what people want to talk about. They want to talk about their wedding. They want to talk about their honeymoon. They want to talk about they're in love. People don't want to say, like, well, what happens when it really gets hard? And I have so many clients who are incredibly smart, incredibly successful business people, entertainers, and family law is like a foreign language. And they are shocked and appalled about, well, I didn't know that X, Y, and Z, and why should they? You know, nobody's sitting anybody down before they get married unless they do a prenup and saying, you know, here's what's going to happen if you put your money in the same account or if you do this or you do that.
Right. And so talking about children, though, what about cases where there's special needs children and having to figure out determining long-term care, therapy, educational costs around that in custody cases? How have you seen some of those situations work out?
So that is tricky. There tends to be, and again, this is just anecdotally and what I've seen with clients in my practice, but where the conflict arises is where one person kind of, for lack of a better word, takes it less seriously. So one person says like, oh my gosh, these special needs are so, you know, severe and we need all these treatments or we need all of these interventions. And the other person saying like, oh, they're fine, you know, let them be a kid. And maybe the truth is probably somewhere in between. But people kind of, their positions get really solidified in a divorce where they feel like the other parent isn't taking it as seriously. Or vice versa, the other parent is damaging the child by overtreating them. And that's like a very common dynamic that I see with special needs kids, unfortunately. I think it's, you know, I don't know. I'm not going to quote any statistic because I don't know, but I feel like I've heard that families that have a special needs child, I think the rate of divorce is higher probably generally anyway because of the stress level of taking care. And, you know, special needs can be a huge range of things, but you know, that adds a layer of stress to a family even from the start. So if people are not aligned, that can really lead to a lot of breakdowns. And I'm going a little bit off track of your question, but it's kind of interesting. You also see, even in families without special needs kids, just, you know, one parent will still really want to micromanage the other parent. And micromanage is maybe even too strong a word. They want to know that the kid is getting homework done, brushing their teeth, you know, getting dressed nicely in the morning for school. And I've had people call me and say, you know, oh my gosh, I picked her up from school today and her hair wasn't brushed. And, you know, she was wearing these old socks and what can we do? And I'm like, let go of some of that control because unfortunately or fortunately, whatever, you know, your viewpoint is, the court system is not equipped to litigate, you know, that kind of thing. Unfortunately, they're really like, is something on fire? Otherwise, you know, we're not really, these are parenting decisions and people are going to parent differently in two different homes. And having to get used to that is incredibly hard for people. And I completely understand why, because, you know, these are their kids and they're completely letting go of control when they're at that other person's house. So when you add on that extra layer of special needs, I think it heightens things. We have a lot of tools in family law, which if people have the means are great. Co-parenting counselors, there are mental health professionals that can get involved and really help people navigate post-divorce life. I'm great at, you know, writing agreements, giving legal advice, going to court, but I'm not a mental health professional. So to talk about how do we talk to the kids about X or how do we figure out how to navigate being at an appointment with this child when we have different views, that person, that's their entire job. So we really, really use those people where we can.
Yeah, they're great. I've had one on and she was amazing. And so also under the same kind of custody challenges, sometimes a parent may claim that they're being undermined by the other parent so that the child thinks a certain way about the other parent. And you see this happening. How do you kind of help address that? Or is that something also the coach can help with?
Well, definitely the co-parenting person can help. That is a very, very hard issue to deal with. And people used to refer to it as alienation. That's not really the right term anymore psychologically. So now we talk about gatekeeping, restrictive gatekeeping. We talk about other kinds of terms for it. But basically, and it's also on a huge spectrum, right? There's somebody that might just be like, oh, your dad's an idiot. and say that in front of the kid, you know, and probably people have said that in intact families too, right? Versus somebody who, you know, on the other end of the spectrum is actively trying to turn a child away from another parent. And I have had cases, I had a case where dad had not seen his daughter, came to me when maybe she was 9, and he had not seen her since she was 5. So it had been 4 years. And ultimately it took a lot. So a lot of what we call a reunification therapist. And again, this is on this kind of far end of the extreme. But eventually, I think when she was 12 or 13, they were reunified after all these steps of writing letters and phone calls and Zooms. And finally, now they have a relationship. And it's like one of the greatest things I could have ever been involved in, because it was heartbreaking. And he said to me something like, because he never gave up. And he never just said, you know what, forget it, this is too hard. He just said, I need to be able to show her whenever it is, whether it's when she's an adult or when she's 12, that I did everything I could. And here's every time I went to court and I asked and I asked and I asked and I tried, because I don't want her to think that I just gave up and said, you know what, I don't care about this relationship. So thankfully it paid off for him. But it's really, those cases are so hard. And the people that do that reunification work are so few and far between, because it's so hard. But yeah, I mean, that's really the extreme end of it. Certainly you see it in more mild or moderate versions in a lot of custody cases. And just even people don't realize that they're doing it sometimes too. It's like, it's not intentional. They're just angry and they don't know how to process that without looping these kids into it.
So like for that case, is that something that goes to a judge, or is that like stuff, things you work on outside of the court? Because will the judge even care? Will they be like, well, it's not my problem, you know?
Well, I mean, the judge will care. It's just a matter of what can the judge do about it. And that's where it gets really hard. And I've had some really, really hard cases where the judge has said, you know, mom, you have to bring the child to this place at this time and you have to do it. And, you know, if the mom just says like, well, she won't come, I can't get her in the car, then what do they do? You know, nobody's going to call the police and drag a child and screaming and put them in the car. So then what are the next steps from there? And that's what's really, really tricky, and where you do have to kind of think creatively, have somebody else, you know, remove the alienating, for lack of a better word, parent from the picture. And maybe that child needs to get picked up from school or an activity with somebody else, and a therapist is there. And I mean, there's a million different iterations of it, but courts, our family law judges are amazing, but they are completely up to their necks. And so for them to be able to come up with these solutions and deal with this day after day, it's very hard. They don't have the time. So the best bet is for people to try to figure out collaboratively some other approach. But it's one of the hardest kinds of case, I think.
Right. Yeah. And so I'm also curious about post-nups and how those end up working out. Since, you know, most of the time I would think a post-nup happens because there is some sort of growth and wealth, and you need some protection. And I imagine those conversations are difficult.
Yes. Postnups are definitely not as common as prenups. They can happen for a few reasons. One is people just run out of time before their wedding. Like, I had somebody call me maybe in the beginning of the summer, and she said, I'm getting married in, you know, 5 weeks. And I said, oh, well, then I'm not the right person to do the prenup. We really want to have a longer lead time. And then she said, oh, so what are my options? And I said, well, you can, you know, talk with another lawyer that might be able to do it quickly, or you could do a postnup. And I explained to her kind of the pros and cons of that. And that's where I think she landed. And, you know, after she gets married, she's going to, you know, get a postnup done. So that's one kind of less exciting way that it comes about. Other ways are, like you said, I mean, somebody has a huge change in their financial situation and they say, oh, we did not anticipate this, and here's how we want this to work. Or, I mean, maybe even the most common time is where people start to kind of think about divorce and then they say, is it better that we just, since this may happen, let's sit down while we're both more level-headed and really think about it, as opposed to like in the throes of this really emotional experience, which I kind of respect, but those types tend to end up just shifting into a divorce judgment because those people, you know, I don't know what the statistic is, but they, we see often where we'll start doing a post-nup with somebody and then they're just say, you know what, this relationship's over, let's go ahead and make this into a divorce case. So
right. And so how much lead time do you need when you're doing a prenup?
I prefer at least 3 months from the wedding. I mean, I would like way more if I can. I just did one where, thankfully, I said, you know, when's your wedding date? And he said, I don't know, after the prenup's done. Like, I'm not even setting the wedding until the prenup's done. I said, that's music to my ears because, you know, it can take time. But 3 months is usually feels fine as long as everybody's, you know, retained counsel and we can work through it. But, you know, to have a careful drafting, a careful review, everybody doesn't feel, you know, nobody wants the signing on the morning of the wedding situation. So
definitely. And so in a prenup, are people submitting, you know, total debt outstanding and all assets? Or have you had cases where you had to do more searches in order to discover that? Because as we know, if you get married, any debt acquired during marriage is the responsibility of both partners.
That is absolutely correct. So I think the good news about prenups maybe in that context is that usually you're doing them because people have, at least one of the people have wealth to protect. So I haven't personally come across a situation yet where there's some extraordinary amount of debt that was undisclosed. I'm sure it happens. But technically what you're supposed to do, and this is to ensure your prenup is enforceable, is to disclose everything, including debts, including all your assets. Even, you know, we have a lot of clients who maybe have some kind of trust for them. Even if it's not, even if they don't have discretion over the trust, we still like to list it because that's a potential source of wealth in the future. We typically attach 2 to 3 years of tax returns for both parties. So that's very clear what their income is like. And because again, if we're going to draft it, we want it to be enforced. So if anything's left off, that will create some weakness.
Got it. Have you ever had a case where there was a significant amount of debt acquired during the marriage and it was so egregious that the court was like, okay, it's not the responsibility of the other partner because this other person went off the deep end?
Kind of. What I see more is, and you can call it debt or you can just call it like money that was used, wasted, whatever we want to call it. We have these cases where somebody has a mistress, a girlfriend, has paid for relationships with an escort and spent significant amounts of community property money on that. And in those cases, those typically don't end up going to court because people have some kind of guilt and end up settling them. But as part of the settlement, you know, we're like, you got to pay some of this back. You know, this was not agreed upon spending of community property. And, you know, I've heard people try to make an argument like, well, but, you know, everybody goes out and, you know, she went to the spa and she went to, you know, Neiman Marcus and bought herself purses. And I'm like, well, I think that's a little bit different than buying, you know, paying for an escort, you know, or even buying gifts for another girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, which that we also have seen. And we've had to kind of go through people's statements and say like, okay, was this jewelry for your wife or for your girlfriend? And you should probably reimburse that because you don't want to be litigating that issue.
What about things like gambling and like if he or she creates some crypto account and you had no idea he sunk, you know, 100K into it? What about situations like that?
So really what that kind of the umbrella that all falls under is this idea of fiduciary duty, which you probably know that in terms of financially what that means, but spouses have a fiduciary duty to each other. And that's another thing people don't realize when they get married often. And so if somebody gambled an incredible amount of money or did something kind of reckless with money during marriage, that would potentially trigger that to say, look, you know, you're going to have some obligation because that damaged the community. And a piece of that is going to be, did the other person know about it? Did they approve it? Did they say, oh, yeah, go gamble, it's totally great? Or kind of what, that's what makes family law interesting, I think. It's always so fact intensive. So it's like, what did that, how did that even happen? How did that develop? How did we get there? And that may all play into whether there's a claim. Because then you have the other cases where somebody will say, well, you invested in this really risky, you know, private investment, or you sold shares at a time you shouldn't have sold them and you owe me for that. And on that level, we can't apply that level of scrutiny to regular people getting divorced, because anybody, you know what I mean? So it has to really kind of raise above the level of just like making a financial decision that maybe didn't work out. So it's an interesting line.
Got it. Interesting. Okay. And so when income shifts drastically, at what point does it make sense to have a child support modification?
Oh, interesting. So child support is based upon a few main factors, one being income, as you said, and the other being timeshare. So how much time each person has with the children. And so it just kind of depends how much it actually affects the amount of the ultimate child support. So in other states, not California, they have even a rule about when you can request modification. Like, you can't request unless it changes the number by 5%, 10%, making up something like that, because they don't want people coming in.
Yeah, for extra $100.
Right, exactly. So what I tell people if they come in is like, well, here's what it's going to cost you to litigate it, and here's kind of what I think the delta is. Like, is this worth it to you? So really, it's fact intensive, case by case. But I honestly don't see people changing their child support that much. I like to build in where I can, if people are agreeable to it, like some kind of, if the children are young, some kind of step up over time, or step down, whatever makes more sense. It doesn't prevent anybody from coming back, because child support always modifiable. But if it's already built in, then at least there's an opportunity for people to not have to go to court if they're good with how it's evolving over time. So that's a long-winded way of saying it really depends on kind of what their situation is.
When would you determine that step up, and what type of scenario, like an example?
Well, the most common scenario is where somebody's custody is changing and we know it. For example, we have a parent that's starting off with maybe 25% time with kids, and we build in a schedule where they're going to get up to 50%. So we say, once you're at the 50, your child support's also going to adjust downwards too. So that would be a very clear time when we would do it. Other times I've seen it is just where kids are very young, and we say, you know, kids that are one need less child support than kids that are 12. And so maybe we build in one or two times where child support will step up, and we hope, it's usually when I'm representing the person with the greater wealth, and they want to prevent having to come back and do everything over again. So they're happy. Happy is the wrong word. They're
satisfied.
Yeah, exactly. They're motivated by the idea of saying, okay, let's just stay out of court on this, because, you know, they understand the value of not having to litigate and pay lawyers to deal with this, you know, time and time again.
Right. Which is another example of why you really need to have a good attorney on your side, like Jennifer, who can anticipate these various potential future situations and have it embedded into your agreement, so you don't have to keep coming back. So I think that's a great idea. Have you ever had to deal with international custody issues, like one spouse wants to now live in the UK and the other one stays in LA? How do you deal with that?
I had that exact case, actually, where one spouse wanted to live in the UK. We talk about move away cases. That's what we call them, and whether it's international or not. And it's interesting. I mean, in Los Angeles, and you know this, having living here, we can have a move away case within Los Angeles County, because if one person lives, you know, at one side of it and the other person wants to move to the other side, I mean, and that creates, here's how I explain move aways to clients. Is it going to make your current schedule not possible anymore? So if people have a week on, week off schedule, for example, and moving an hour away, they'll still be able to accommodate it, then it's not a move away because they can still do what they need to do. If it's going to make it so that certainly out of state or, you know, something where they can't accommodate the 225 schedule that they're doing, then they need to request a move away. And yes, the farther they go, the harder it is, because the court has to assume when, let's say I have a client, mom wants to move to the UK, we have to assume she's moving. The court can't say like, well, really, you should stay here and share custody. That's what's best for the kids. They have to say mom's there, dad's here, where are the kids? And so when you make that assumption and the kids have been here for a while and they have school and they have pediatricians and they have friends and they have activities, that's a big ask to move those kids to a completely different place, unless you have an extraordinary amount of custody time. You know, you have 90% of the time with these kids, and it would be detrimental to completely flip that. There's a lot of parts that go into it, but those cases are, I think, hard to win for the moving away person, even if they have every good intention. But they can be won. It's just the court wants to see what's the person's motivation. Are they trying to just get away from the other person, cut that person out of the kids' lives? That's not usually looked upon very kindly. Or is it, look, I have family there. My job opportunities are there. It's really not working for us here. This is how I'm going to make it work. You know, we have the means to be able to travel internationally back and forth. Whatever that looks like, those are going to be the cases that, you know, you have a better shot.
Hypothetically, if the parent takes the children to the UK, and then doesn't, if they have agreement, like the other spouse sees the kids and gets the kids in the summer or something, and the parent doesn't, you know, meet that expectation, do you as an attorney in LA have the ability to bring that parent and the kids back, like to force that parent to bring the kids back to the parent in LA? I'm just like hypothetically thinking out a scenario.
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially considered kidnapping, for lack of a better word, if you don't comply with the orders and you're keeping the children out of the jurisdiction. And then I don't know if in your talking with other family law counsel, you've heard like this Hague idea. There's these Hague cases where basically if there's an international custody issue where one side either, like you said, goes to UK, they're allowed to be there, but then kids are supposed to come back to California and they don't, and they're withholding the children there and they will not return them, then we have what's called a Hague case where there has to be a determination of jurisdiction, and then basically these jurisdictions fight it out and there's a request to return to America. I've also worked on a case, parents lived in Italy, had a child, mom took child from Italy, moved to California, and alleged that dad was abusing the child, and that's why she fled. And that ended up being a years-long, messy, crazy case with appeal. We represented dad, and it turned, you know, he was completely vindicated. There was no, she made it up, and the child was returned to dad in Italy, which was really horrendous for this kid. I mean, not the return, but the whole experience. So yeah, those cases, and to be perfectly honest, that's such a subspecialty too. I've done them and I've worked on them, but I like to bring in other counsel that deal with that international kind of specific issue where I can, because it's that kind of litigation is kind of a whole other subset of family law as well.
Interesting. Okay. And I had a question on if you're gifted money from your family and you're married, how does that get divvied up?
So the classic family law answer is it depends. But if it's clearly delineated, so mom and dad give to, let's call the son Kevin, you know, here, Kevin, Christmas card. Dear Kevin, we love you. For Christmas, we're giving you $25,000. Here's a check. That's Kevin's money. That is a gift. That's his separate property. If he keeps it separate, it will be clear. Even if he doesn't keep it separate, if he can trace it, that's going to be his dollars. Let's say the opposite is true. They write, dear Kevin and Angela, we're giving you $25,000. That's a joint gift. Half of each is theirs. But what you more often see is these gifts where it's like, was it for one? Was it for the other? Was it for both of them? Because people aren't typically putting in writing. I mean, they might put a name on the check, but even that's not necessarily definitive because maybe one person has the account. So we've definitely seen these cases where it's not clear, and it happens a lot when people give money for the purchase of a house.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, like the down payment.
Exactly. I was like, well, my parents gave us money for the house. And I always say, well, did they give it to you? Did they give it to you? Who did they give it to? And it's not always clear. Sometimes it is, and where you can prove it and it's beneficial to your client, great. But it's definitely those are the kind of what you look for is like, who is the gift intended for and how can you prove that? And, you know, these are things, again, that people don't necessarily think about when they're in a marriage until it's over.
And I could see that being a huge issue since real estate is a big part of people's portfolio, especially in investing and saving for the future.
And I mean, most people that are getting divorced, if they own a home, that is typically people's biggest asset. Definitely something to unwind. Have another case now where one person's parents stayed on the loan, on the mortgage. So it's three of them on the mortgage, wife, husband, and husband's father. And so now we're trying to figure out, she's going to keep the house. How do we get them off? Like it's unwinding these kind of well-intentioned family plans are sometimes hard. So
yeah, that's going to be tricky with refinancing. Hopefully she can assume the loan, but that might be difficult.
Well, correct. We used to, in many cases, just say when one person was awarded the house, you know, they'll make best efforts to refinance and get the other person off the loan and we'll give them 6 months. And that, you know, even just a couple of years ago, wasn't an impossible task. And now people are saying, like, I don't want to refinance. I'm never going to get this rate again. So that we either have to negotiate for the other person to stay on for a certain period of time. And they kind of, what can we give them to get them to do that? Or the person just says, look, I can't afford to keep the house if I have to do that. So I guess we have to sell it. So it's different kind of decisions.
Yeah. And if the other person stays on, then it's on their credit as well, which can affect them
exactly.
Buying another house or renting.
There has to be a level of trust and kind of understanding and I've done it and people have successfully done it, which is great, but it's definitely not the norm.
And so have you had a complex asset, whether it be something offshore or crypto or some intellectual property, something that's been complex and difficult for you to be able to value or divvy up?
So interestingly, haven't seen a ton of crypto cases. I have one now where I'm doing the prenup, but that's a little bit different. But sometimes the trickiest ones aren't just what you described. It's we have a lot of entertainers, and so kind of residuals and dealing with kind of intellectual property in terms of movie rights and things that stem, because, you know, as you well understand, everything during the marriage, unless there's a prenup, is community property, including efforts. So if somebody does a movie during marriage and then they get divorced and there's a sequel, well, is there some, you know, what does their judgment say? How is that going to work? Is that something that stemmed from work prior to the separation? Those kind of things can sometimes be tricky, and valuing those and making decisions about them. Another one that's very tricky in kind of a different, unexpected way is law firm. We have a case where somebody is the owner of a law firm, and it's a huge, how do you value that? It's a contingency-based law firm with tons and tons and tons of cases, and wife used to be involved in it, and now she's not, and the kind of the intricacies of that is outside of the day-to-day norm of what we're looking at. Because a law firm, generally, we value those, and forensic accountants will get involved and give us valuation. But this one in particular just runs a little bit different than the average firm. And so we really worked hard with forensics to figure out what's the best way of doing this. How do we divide up efforts pre and post separation when we don't really know who was working on the case when, because they don't keep typical billable time? All of these things.
And just so the audience knows too, contingency law firms, they get paid a percentage of this a settlement.
Right.
Right. So to forecast their valuation is very difficult because you don't know.
You don't know when, you know, when is the money earned? Is it earned at the time of receipt? Because we look, you know, in family law, we tend to look at, like, a very simple example. Somebody gets a bonus. Is that bonus, maybe that bonus is paid right after the people separate, but it was for work that they did during marriage. So that's a community property bonus, right? We don't care when it's received, we care when it was earned. And when we look at contingency cases in this law firm, these cases are worked on for a long period of time. So how do we divide up the work? What if they did a ton of work at the beginning of the case and then they sat on it for a while and then some at the end? So we don't want to give it a typical time rule. We want to change that around. It was a very interesting case to work on, but it was, you know, family law was developed for the majority of people that just have regular W-2 jobs. And, you know, that's what the majority of people going through divorce in California. So when we have clients that have these kind of extraordinary situations, you got to be creative.
So what happens there? Is it better for her to keep her share of the firm?
Maybe.
Right. Yeah. Since you don't know what cases you'll have and what the revenue stream will look like in the future.
Exactly. And it was talked about, you know, do we want to have some kind of percentage that goes down over time? Because, you know, as time goes on, the cases are only being worked on by the separate spouse now, so she shouldn't maintain her same community interest over time, so that needs to kind of peter out. So anyway, so that those are the kind of interesting things that make this job never boring, because it's just every case is different. You're learning about people's businesses, you're learning about how they work, you're learning about how they make their money, how they parent. I mean, it's just, and then kind of trying to fit all of that within the constructs of what we can do. So
yeah, amazing. Very interesting. And lastly, as you know, the name of the podcast is The Click Line, When Everything Clicks. When was there a moment in your personal or professional life that you're like, ah, this clicks for me?
It's a great question. I guess it was mostly my professional life, but affected my personal life too. I was not somebody that always knew I wanted to be a lawyer. Nobody in my family was a lawyer. So it wasn't something I really discovered until I went to college and I did an internship, in a legal aid firm in New York City. And I found it to be so interesting. They were working with juvenile delinquents, for lack of a better word. It was the juvenile delinquency department, and representing these kids that were arrested. And so kind of the personal nature of the work I found so compelling. I was a psych major, so I liked that idea of, like, human interaction. But I'm also pretty type A, so I liked also the idea of, like, writing and research and deadlines and rules. So for me, it just kind of starting from that internship through some other work at family law firms during law school, I just realized, oh, this is the exact kind of combination of my skill set and what I enjoy doing. So that's how I ended up where I am sitting today. And it's just been, it's really worked out nicely. Stressful job sometimes, but ultimately very fulfilling.
Yeah, very rewarding that you're able to help people and their families. So Very cool. Thank you so much, Jennifer. I really appreciate you being on. I know you're very busy with lots of cases in court, but I appreciate you taking the time. Congratulations again for getting accepted to the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. A huge, huge success for you. And we wish you all the best. Thank you again for being on the Click Line.
Thank you, Mina. This was great. Thanks so much.
Don't forget to send in your questions and comments to the Click Line. And one more thing, the views and opinions expressed on this podcast are for informational and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered professional advice. Please consult with qualified professionals for advice related to your specific situation.